All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I assume most of you have been here before. Maybe there's some new people. I don't know why this would be the day that you would check in all of a sudden. But if you're here, welcome. If you don't know what we do here, we talk openly and honestly about the struggles of being a human being on almost all levels. We talk freely and openly about many different things. Vulnerability, creativity, art, work, fear, substance abuse, politics. We talk about everything with people to get to the heart of what people are. I think that's what we do here. So if that sounds good, welcome. If you already knew that's what we did here, well, there you go. Sorry, you know, like, what am I doing? You know, what am I doing right now? What am I even talking about right now? Jesus Christ, tomorrow is, like, this, it's like I'm beyond stress, I'm post-fear, I'm post-nervousness, I'm in some sort of strange paralysis that feels like the present, that feels like acceptance on some level. I know what we're up against. I know all the machinations of the garbage people and what they're going to try to do to steal the country, to destroy democracy. I know all of that. I know how the voting works. I know what we're up against. You know, in the next day or two or next week or next month, we'll know whether American democracy is over or we get new management and try to salvage what's left from the wreckage. So either we'll get that opportunity with new management to salvage what's left of our institutions, our norms, our system of government. We'll be able to salvage that with new management. You know, perhaps take a responsible approach to this sickness that's leveling the global economy and destroying people. Perhaps we'll get a chance to salvage that with new management, new leadership, or else it will be sold as salvage by the current situation, by the garbage people and the grifters and the con men and the incompetent children put in charge of big bureaucracies that a lot of people depend on who give zero fucks about those people's lives. Sold as salvage. It's a fucking nightmare, but that's the precipice we're on. And I don't know why I've arrived where I'm at today, the day before this election. And go vote if you haven't, for fuck's sake. And there's no excuse not to, really. There's no principle you can sit on for that one. Well, I'm not going to vote because shut up. Before I get too caught up, let's lighten it up a little bit. I made a cake. Anyway, Dave Cross is on the show today. Now, Dave's been on before. Dave's an old friend of mine. This is actually Dave's sixth time on the show. He's been on two live ones, two in the garage, one on the phone. But this is actually the first time we've talked to Dave in a while. And, you know, he's in this new movie where I think he really puts the work in as an actor. But more importantly, you know, I saw him on TV. I was just flipping around, and I've talked a bit about this before. You know, I don't know if it's nostalgia or just taking stock of who we are by going over our past. And I was watching Dave Cross on TV on one of his specials, and there was just something so familiar about the way Dave talked and moved and thought. You know, from back in the day, you know, we kind of started out together. And it made me remember, made me feel, made me know that I came from someplace and that I arrived somewhere else. When I showed up in Boston and I met all these dudes and, you know, I committed my life, my fucking heart to stand-up comedy, you become sort of this weird family. It's not necessarily that supportive or whatever, but we were a crew of fucking gypsies and weirdos, you know, bordering on outlaws. Just trying to find our way in this goddamn racket and try to figure out who we were up there. And, you know, he was part of that beginnings. And he's one of the guys who I see, and he's remained himself at his core in a way. But I've seen him kind of grow up. But whatever the fact is, whatever the case, the familiarity made me feel good. It made me feel emotional. It made me feel like I have memories and friends in the world that I can be grateful for and be happy about. And then it just came to be that Dave and I get to talk. He's got this got this new movie out. It's called The Dark Divide. It's playing in theaters and in virtual cinema. You can go to darkdividefilm.com to find out the best way to see it, based on a true story. We'll talk to him about that and about other stuff. But getting back to it, tomorrow, I don't know what to expect, but I'm going away. Gonna have somebody set up shop here at the house for a few days and watch my little cat Buster. And I'm going to just go up and isolate, really. I'm going to isolate, try to disconnect until the 4th. And by then, it should be, everything should be on fire with no known winner and Trump declaring himself the winner. And, you know, just flaming violence in every major city. I'm kidding. That can't happen. What? Can it? We'll see. But the truth is, I have to prepare. I have to prepare. And I guess this is how I framed it, sadly, that either we're going to get the new management or we're going to enter into a very dark, authoritarian time, an aggressively sort of kind of proud fascistic time of minority rule and chaos that has happened to many countries around the world. Most countries have gone through it. For some reason, we just didn't think it could happen here. And now we know how fragile it all is, don't we? And we'll see what happens. I think there is a better outcome, obviously. New management would be good, but it's going to be an uphill slog. But the weird thing is we know who everybody is now. Everybody knows who their neighbors are. Everyone knows who their family is and where they stand. Who are the people that crave fascism? Who are the people that crave simplicity, a kind of myopic, minimal spectrum of human expression, art, ethnicity, gender, choices. And it's interesting now to see, you know, who's jockeying for relevance in the possibility of authoritarianism. What is the fascistic demographic? Who's going to play to the fascist demographic? Like, obviously, you talk about these bubbles, and these bubbles are political, and people are being misinformed by their bubble. Like, if you talk about the Fox News bubble, you know, you can see the simplicity of it. You can see the editorialization of it. You can see them avoiding certain stories to feed a propaganda machine that engages and encourages American fascism. You can see it. And there's no follow-up. When those people want to source their information, they go straight to the bullshit spigot and connect the dots land of random conspiracy theories. So that's that. There's your demographic. Who are the entertainers in that future? I don't know. A few country artists, a couple of podcasters that we know, a few comics, Kanye. But whatever it is, the fascistic demographic will exist and be marketed to. That's how capitalism is going to survive. Hopefully it will not be the form of government. We'd be better off if it just becomes a demographic of sorts, as opposed to the replacement of democracy. I don't know, man. I just don't know. Do you? You know, I made a cake the other day. I told you about the failed Kentucky butter cake, but it's just in my mind. It's just the way I am. I'm like, I got to fucking master this. So I went at it again, and I made a beautiful Kentucky butter cake, whatever that is. Powdered sugar on top, had some nice slices, gave my friend Kip part of it, gave my neighbor a couple slices, gave my therapist a slice, still had many slices left. 3 days in, I finally threw the remaining three slices away because nobody wants three-day-old cake. And I had already eaten like half of it. Not to mention I'm sitting on a trove of fucking Halloween candy. Nobody came out for Halloween. I guess in L.A. they said you couldn't. I didn't even know that, and I already bought the goddamn candy. I was out in the street chasing kids down. The two or three that were out there with their parents, I had to go out in front, you know, at the end of my sidewalk and look around and go like, you want candy? I got candy. I got candy over here. Who wants the candy? Some people know costumes. So one kid walking around dressed as a cop had a weird moment where I thought he was dressed as an ICE agent. But it wasn't. It was just a cop, and he had a whistle. Must have been for this kid. Didn't even know what he was doing. Just blowing on the whistle with his mom wandering him around, walking him around. And gave him some candy, and I gave a Teenage Mutant Ninja some candy and a couple of witchy-looking girls a little bit of candy with their folks, and everybody's wearing masks. I'm not wearing the scary mask, or maybe I'm wearing the scariest mask of all. The mask of hopelessness in the face of plague. What'd you go as? A frightened middle-aged man who can't see the future clearly anymore and is battling with hope and existential despair. Wow, that's scary. I know. And all it took is just a little mask, and I was able to pull it off. So now I got a bunch of that candy. Cake's gone, though. I'm going to go away for a few days and see if I can do that. It's weird. I'm going myself, but I'm going myself. Dave Cross is an old friend, and I was happy to talk to him. His new movie, The Dark Divide, is now playing in theaters and virtual cinema. You can go to darkdividefilm.com to find the best way to see it. We also talk about how we're both playing Jerry Wexler in two different Aretha Franklin projects. And also, we tried this new thing where we sent Dave a microphone that he could use. It's pretty easy to use. And we're trying to get the sound quality up a bit. And we sent him the microphone. And we spent 15 minutes trying to help him set it up, which was, as you know, Dave, how is that not going to be hilarious, right? All right. This is me talking to my old friend, David Cross. Hello, David.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
What's the matter?
I forgot we were friends. So yeah, it could be better. It could be worse. That's right. I'm not here for a job interview.
Right. Yeah, it's me, Mark. Remember?
So did you haven't used this before?
I've used it here at home. I tried it to make sure it was good. And it does give a pretty good...
What's this? Is this better?
That's great to me.
Thank you guys so much for gifting me this microphone, too.
Wait a minute. I thought we were... That's what I said to Brendan. I said to Brendan right before this, you're the first guy we sent it to. I'm like, we're going to have to get another one because someone's not going to send this back, you know?
Well, when I got it in the mail, nobody told me this was coming or to expect it. And I got this box from Marc Maron, you know, an old boot box, maybe right. Not even that old boot. You seem like the kind of guy who collects boots.
Am I right? Yeah. What does that mean? Why would you say that?
It means you have more than a pair of boots.
That's yes. But what, so, but
well, why are you seeing this as a negative?
Because what does that mean about me?
You immediately got defensive.
How many
people
boots?
Collect things, Mark, all over. It's a fine thing to do. You know, it kind of goes against, hippie.
No. People know I collect boots. I just like boots, and I
didn't know that.
I have quite a few boots.
It makes sense. You seem like a kind of guy who collects boots.
Okay.
And then is like also, oddly, I don't want to say shy about it, but it feels a sense of shame. Clearly.
Well, I just wanted to know if there was judgment in what you were saying. You know.
I understand. I think you that's your default. You just go to, I'm being judged on, you know.
But just tell me.
Can I get some milk? 2% or whole? Oh, God, what do I say? 2%? No, whole. No, 2%.
All right. But you were judging me when you said that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, so you got it. You got the box from me.
I got the box, and I was like, oh, this is, you know, he's. And he seems like the kind of guy who would do this is just sort of randomly send me, not necessarily because it's me, but just send a like a present or something that I initially thought, oh, this is going to be something from the 80s that you found that, is personal to the
something we had. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And And I just gotten back from
Do I seem
Atlanta.
Like that guy that's going to send you a thing from
Yeah, I mean, I think you would. I think you...
There's that hat. Remember the hat?
Well, yeah, why not?
Yeah.
If you found something, I mean, now that you have an assistant, I don't think you'd do it on your own. I don't think you'd take it and go down to the post office yourself and wait in line. But if you have an assistant where you can go, hey, Jenny, you want to, here's an address. Go send this to my friend Dave.
Frank.
You would do that.
I have Frank. He's part-time. He doesn't live here. Doesn't check my emails for me. I was at the post office myself today. I'm not saying that you're being judgmental, but maybe I'm being a little defensive.
Okay, that's fine. But but you acknowledge that.
I had somebody do that, yeah.
Yeah, you acknowledge that you wouldn't necessarily do it. You'd be more inclined to, if you had an assistant, as I would too. If I had an assistant, I'd say, I would say Jenny, because I would only hire an assistant named Jenny or somebody willing to answer to Jenny. I'd say, right. Jenny, will you take this down to the post office? Now, I'm in Brooklyn, so the post office is literally, 75 yards away. It's not a big deal. And if it was raining or inclement weather, I'd say, wait on it. It's just Marc Maron. It's just a hat for Marc Maron. It can wait a day or two till it clears up. So I'm saying that we're brothers in that.
Yes, and that you weren't expecting the mic, so it came, and you didn't know anything about it. You didn't know if it was a gift or anything. Was there no instruction at all? Nothing. You just had
no.
So it when was, you're when you're publicist,
well, I didn't open it up at first. I had just gotten back. I traveled all day with my 3.5-year-old, just the two of us, and on the plane, getting from the airport with luggage and all this stuff.
Oh my God, you're flying during this shitstorm?
I had to go to Atlanta to finish shooting something that shut down during COVID.
Right.
So we almost done. I was halfway through episode 6, only one more episode after that, and it shut down, and I had to come back here. Everything just turned to shit.
Right.
And I had to go back in and, they started up again. Very safe. It was very, I was nervous, quite nervous at first.
Let me ask you something about that. So, because I've been offered a couple things here and there, and I'm just sort of like, if I don't have to do it, I'm not doing it. But, okay, so it was safe, but was it any fun at all? Does the fear ruin the fun?
No, it was... it was a much different situation than before. You couldn't have a lot of people in one place while you're shooting. So it was sort of blocked in a much different way than it would normally be blocked, your scenes, and shot a little bit differently. But the level of, we were tested every 2 days.
Yeah.
And you don't walk in. Everything was in 3 zones, right? So you had people in zone A, zone B, and zone C, and you couldn't interact with other people. All rehearsals were done with masks and shields. And then you just take them off for the actual scene. And obviously, because it's porn, it's like much more intense. There's a lot
of
germs flying all around. But...
you were able to make do?
If that's a euphemism, yeah. Yeah. And but yeah, it was I was very nervous about everything, even flying, and I thought that both airports, LaGuardia and Atlanta, were really on top of everything. The actual flight was very safe. I was very, very nervous because we've been so careful here, my family and I, and it was really bad. Like
in March,
mid March to mid April was scary and weird and surreal. And I think that's in part why New York rallied like they did, because it was so bad. And we just have less of those, dumb people. I mean, there's a plenty in like Staten Island and Long Island,
right.
But, we don't have those like, it's tyranny, I can't breathe, we don't have that.
Yeah.
It's not that part of the country. And so, but yeah, just to get back to it, it was. I felt very safe. Yeah.
Yeah, because
This is for the thing that you we're playing dual Jerry Wexlers.
Yeah, so we're doing dueling Wexlers.
Yes, pretty cool.
It is cool, but I let me hear your Wexler voice.
You know, it was deeper. It was because I got the audio. There wasn't a whole lot of audio I could.
There was
use,
a little but, bit of audio, yeah. And he talked like yeah. this, right? But I didn't go
yeah, he
deeper.
Was, he was Bronx. He was like, Bronx. You know.
Yeah, but you went deeper. You actually went deeper. I kept it around here. You know, I talk like this and talk to normal.
Believe me, I would have preferred to do that, but that's how we. You know, it would be easier, I guess, to do that because I would always. And I mean always, by take three, I'd be right back up to that pitch. That's, you know, that's mine, like more like this.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you got something to say. And because he talks pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And yeah. And I would find myself rising up and the director would
say, so wait, you did a bunch of episodes as Wexler?
Yes.
Because I'm just in, like, we just did the movie. So you did the scene where, did you do the scene where you yell at the guy who runs the studio?
No.
Did you have a fight with that guy? No?
That sounds, what, the Muscle Shoals? Shoals
yeah,
studio?
Rick, yeah.
No, I thought Ted had the fight with him.
No, he did, yeah. The Ted had one.
Oh, and then Jerry says something. No, I mean, unfortunately, that sounds like it would have been fun and juicy. I didn't have a whole lot of juicy stuff to do in it.
Did you have to change a lot of outfits? How many years? What's the span of the Wexler?
Oh, dude, it went from early, mid-60s, like I want to say 62, and then the last year is 79.
Right.
So lots of outfits, lots of, you know, hair pieces that get thinner and grayer and big.
See, like, I wish I was bald because, like, you know, they, like, seriously,
I understand.
Like, they spent all this money to make a bald wig for me because I had to keep my hair for glow. And I was real nervous about because it was.
Oh.
So,
oh, that's right. Yeah.
So they went through that whole thing to make me bald, like Deborah Messing in your movie. And. But then they do all that, and then they put the little bit of hair on me to make me like Wexler, and it looked ridiculous
because
you can't, your face can't express. You can see. There's no way, no matter how good the bald wig is, that you're not going to see.
I mean, that just begs the question, why did they hire you?
Because she liked me, and she thought we were going to be able to do it this way.
I'm kidding.
But she obviously opted to no wig and just fucking deal with my hair. So, like, there's a little give to that. So
that's good, then.
It worked out all right. Yeah, it was pretty exciting.
He has a lot of hair until the mid early 70s. He has, what era were you doing?
We did the 60s through the, it sort of ends at the concert in the church.
Yeah, that was the second to last episode I shot.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And then the last episode, I'm not in that much. It's really just in the beginning where I tell her I'm leaving Atlantic. And then it's like 5 years later that we catch up. So, yeah.
Oh, right. So when is your Wexler going to air? Because I think our movie's going to air like January.
Oh, they were trying to, they changed it like 3 or 4 times. I mean, I imagine they'll change it even again. It was supposed to air, I think it was supposed to air in the late summer, early fall, like nowish, and then they moved it to they were trying to back into a like Thanksgiving thing, and they were like, there's no way that's going to happen. So I think they're looking at spring of next year. I don't know though.
But did you like, I read his autobiography, which is written by this guy with this guy Ritz, who's kind of an interesting guy in himself, but the autobiography was kind of insane. Did you read it?
I read parts of it. It's to see the footage of that guy and read his whole story. The fact that he just doesn't look like the kind of, I mean, he was like in pool halls when he was 14.
Oh, yeah,
fights.
Yeah.
He doesn't look like that kind of guy at all.
Well, I think the fighting was different and more Jewish then. there was less intensity to the fights back then.
Right. There was more cowering behind things.
Well, he had just like this profound impact on music. I reading about that guy, I was like, holy shit.
Oh, it's insane. I'm sure you know this. He coined the phrase rhythm and blues.
Rhythm and blues.
Him.
Yeah, that was him.
Yeah.
And also, like, you know, his daughter, like, there's some sadness to the whole thing, but he was there all the way through the Allman Brothers. He did Capricorn Records, and he, like, did
all... Dire Straits. He discovered Dire Straits.
It's crazy. And yeah. all these stories about going down to New Orleans to look at talent. Mm-hmm. And he was, anyways, I thought it, you know, to be pretty fascinating.
He's the Rick Rubin of his time, kind of. And I'm not trying to be funny. He was very, there's a parallel, you know.
There kind of is, except it seems to, yeah, I guess so. I guess why not? I tend to romanticize guys who have to get in their cars to, you know, drive. Like, I romanticize a guy who has to get on his phone to make radio stations play the goddamn Aretha Franklin single. You know, like, he's working the phones off, that whole thing. Whereas I don't think Rick had to do that, really.
No, well, Rick probably had pagers and fax machines.
And he probably had Jenny.
From his dorm. He was working out of a dorm
that's
in NYU.
Right. He was, wasn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah.
So, that's a place in Brooklyn you've got there?
Where I am now?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You live in Brooklyn?
I do. I've lived in Brooklyn since 2011.
Really? Because I just remember, but you've still got the place in the country. I just assume you're off the grid. So you got the house up there, and you got a house in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I got the place upstate. 13 years ago.
Wow.
And honestly, never really. Imagine that I would be as into it as I was. I, you know, not trying to be funny, but I discovered some stuff about myself, just how, for somebody who was so, social, especially in New York City, and I'd be out all the time and, albeit awkwardly, I was awkward, but, I'm really antisocial. I didn't, and I've probably become more antisocial as I've gotten older. But I mean, I love it up there. And then, you know, I met Amber, who became my wife, and then we had a kid, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's been the one constant, you know?
Yeah, but so back up like that. So okay. So you found out that you were sort of antisocial, or at least just, you know, better off not. Well, I guess we all used to force ourselves. I mean, you're drinking the beers, you're going out, you're hanging out with people, running around, right?
Yeah,
and then, but because I seem to remember, how long has it been since you've been with Amber?
We met in early 2008, end of February, March 2008.
Wow.
And it was really quick. I mean, we were she was basically moved in a matter of months, and that was it. And we never, you know,
to the Brooklyn,
back,
not in Brooklyn though.
No, that was in East Village.
In the East Village. Now I kind of remember you being at that place, but I can't remember really the last time we hang out at all. So it must be a really long time. But it just struck me. Were you against marriage, or just you didn't see yourself having children? I can't remember which it was.
I was never anti-marriage. I just never understood the reason for it.
Right.
I always thought, you know, if you are going to be with somebody, it's fine.
Yeah.
I never had any kind of anti-marriage stance. I just didn't think it would be for me. I didn't see myself as the kind of person who would be married. I didn't desire it.
Right.
You know, I basically had that stance until I met somebody that I wanted to marry. And that was that. So, you know.
And so, but did she ask you to marry her, or did you ask her to marry you?
Other people asked us to marry each other.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're getting a lot of input.
Yeah, it was very, we were in the middle of a rom-com, and we were taking a train Upper West Side, and we were having kind of an argument, which was, you know, clearly we were covering up this tension between us. And then these people were going why don't you just kiss her? You know, it was there was an old Chinese guy, and there
a
was
lot of people involved.
Yeah. You know, some very spunky, precocious African-American children. There were an elderly Jewish couple.
So you couldn't leave the house without people just coming at you.
As soon as we'd leave, they hung out. They waited for us. And then they were just like, why don't you ask her to marry you? You know,
and then a Mexican polka band started playing.
Yeah.
And you got on your knee. And you asked her. Yeah.
And then and we sold it to Netflix. And, you know, that's how I used the money to buy this place.
And did you do a big wedding thing?
Medium size. We did it upstate, right along the river, over where we live.
I think I kind of remember, 2000 and what?
12.
Wow.
Yeah. We just had our anniversary, like two-ish weeks ago, something like that.
Because I like her, and she's a great writer and good person. You both, mm-hmm. you know, are like-minded. But now this children thing, mm-hmm. was that, did you ever see yourself doing that?
Yeah, for sure.
You did?
For sure. Not in a proactive way. I just could easily picture having a kid. I wanted a kid, but not in... I mean, I even like would daydream like, what if I just adopted by myself? And I just wanted a kid in my life.
You did? Know? Yeah. Well,
Yeah.
So what do you think that is? why'd you want it? Did you have any sort of like I'm going to do it differently? I'm going to have a kid and aggressively change the way I am programmed.
That was probably part of it. That was, I did have a very real, so there are two parts of this. One is the, not actually having a kid or any of the responsibilities, but fantasizing and daydreaming about how that might be nice.
Yeah.
And, having an understanding that my life would change and, in some ways for the better, in some ways for worse. But, also I think a lot of it was, I was looking for an outside force to change my behavior.
So the kid is sort of like a beer replacement.
Well, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Like I was not, I wasn't very, responsible or healthy or,
right.
You know, there was several years in the, early aughts in the East Village where I was enjoying myself, but I think in a deeper sense, I was not enjoying myself. And there was probably a little bit of shame and guilt.
I remember when people were like, cause we, you know, whatever, you know, time we spent together it was real. And, you know, and I love you and we had a deep connection, but over the years we didn't spend that much time together. But I remember it during that time, there were people concerned about you. Like, I remember there was like people were like, he's running around with the strokes with a fishing tackle box of pills.
All right. Well, I don't know if that's really completely accurate, but the idea, sure, that I was very I was very irresponsible and doing all kinds of things I shouldn't do. And again, I was enjoying myself, but I think on some level, I was, you know, understanding that I needed to stop doing that.
Did you get scared for your life?
No, there were certain times where part of the problem is I'm oddly resilient for somebody who's, you know, 5'9" and, you know, 155 pounds. I can really absorb a lot of drugs and alcohol.
Do you remember? Is your stomach okay? Remember when your stomach used to hurt all the time?
Yeah. I mean, part of that is changing, you know, my lifestyle.
Right.
I'm definitely a healthier person than I was.
So you wanted to have the kid because you wanted something outside of yourself to make you change your life.
That's a subconscious thing. I think that was not necessarily, and I probably would allow myself to realize that occasionally, but I think that was covered up by this other idea. Sometimes more sometimes I'd believe it more and sometimes I wouldn't about
right.
You know, that I'd be a really good dad and I had a shitty childhood, shitty dad situation, and I almost owe it to the world to raise a decent kid, you know, whatever. A lot of bullshit, a lot of like white liberal garbage.
Is your dad still alive?
As far as I know, I'm pretty sure I would find out if he died because I have two cousins that every 5 years or so they'll get in touch to say something, and we don't. One is I'm on good terms with one I'm not. But
I thought you were going to say that I would feel a change in the Force.
I don't know how much longer he'll live. I mean, he's, I think he's like, he's got to be like 80, 83, 84, something like that. I'm not exactly sure.
My dad's like 80. I guess my dad's 81. And I talked to him yesterday and I was having some problems with him, but he seems to be losing his mind a bit. And, there's a sweetness to it now where he said, yesterday on the phone, he said, look, I just get worried that someone's going to want to hurt you. And you've done very well with your life. You live the life you want. And but I don't understand why you're not on the cover of Time magazine.
Oh, they giveth and taketh away, don't they?
Really? It went from good for you, I'm proud of you, to like, but you know, you're not.
You're not on the cover of Time.
Yeah.
Well, just lie to him. Just tell him you got a Nobel or something like that.
He said the weirdest thing yesterday. He's like, I don't understand why there's not more Jews doing things. I'm like, what? He's like, there was a time, I think, culturally where I think it was we were talking about the virus and he had Jonas Salk in his mind specifically. And he's like, why aren't there more Jews at the forefront of everything? I'm like, I think there's plenty of Jews working behind the scenes.
Just send him Seth Rogen's IMDb page, you know, yeah. Busy for a little bit.
I should tell him. And with the caveat that he has not been on the cover of Time either.
Right.
But you think your dad, hold on a minute. Oh my God. Breaking news. Keith Raniere. Life in prison.
Good. Good. Good.
That is the most boring documentary I've ever seen in my life, The Vow. Oh my God.
Well, it's like a lot of those documentaries, specifically the kind of new, 10-part series where you're like,
terrible.
This only had to be 7 episodes.
Yeah, but what kind of fucking person would listen to that guy tell them to do anything? I mean, like, he can barely get through a piano song. He says he's a genius. He looks like a little hippie turd. He plays volleyball.
Dude, my favorite thing in the whole thing is it's like one of the earlier episodes where he describes himself as he says, and I'm paraphrasing this, but it's pretty close. I'm one of the world's best problem solvers. I'm actually considered the third best problem solver in the world. Like, there's a ranking of something as vague as problem solving, and somehow he is ranked third
in the world.
Society has deemed him Cambridge University.
Because he thought that would be he thought that would be more believable. But don't you just look at that guy? Wouldn't he be like one of the guys where, like, if we were
Scientology, it's all the same guy.
No, I get it. But look at that guy, though. If you and I back in the day were going to go play softball with some fellas, he would be the guy. Be like, yeah, I just let him come. You know, like it would. He's not. There's no charisma. There's no leadership. It's like he's like the annoying guy that hangs around. How does that?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was the annoying guy at the periphery of your group of friends
right.
at a bar
right.
when you're starting to talk about something that's starting to get deep.
Right.
And he chimes in and you're like, wait, back up, that doesn't make any sense. Like everything he said when he's talking to people, yeah. my reaction, and granted, I'm sitting in my living room with hindsight being, but I would never be in that situation to begin with.
Exactly,
But everything he says and people are nodding along to it, you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. And you know me and I know you and you,
right.
You me, our friends, 90% of them would stop the conversation and right. go, wait, that doesn't make any sense. Explain that. No, what you just said.
Oh, aren't you glad we're not that fucking lost or that fucking craving of that type of sense? But I imagine.
Oh, of course.
But like getting back to your old man and to your like, so you have this sort of, my brother had the same thing with the kids. He's like, I'm going to do it differently. But it seems to me that like everything changed. Like, and I know this because I have friends who have kids and I've gotten to this weird age where I want to hear more about their kids than them. And, I get very attached to their kids. I'm not really particularly sorry that I don't have children, but I do imagine that whatever happened. So was it a discussion with you two, or did she just was she just like, I'm pregnant?
And I feel like I can speak to this because she wrote about it in her second to last book.
Yeah, fucking throw her under the bus, dude. Go ahead.
I'm not throwing her under the bus. She talked about this. She asked me if you know, because so we did get pregnant, and this would have been in 2012, I want to say, 13, maybe, yeah. 12 or 13. And she wanted to get an abortion, and I did not want that. And I was really bummed, and it was very – if you read if you read her book of essays, it's all in there. But
because you were – because, like, how old were you? You were already, what, 45, 50?
Dude, I was I would have been, late 40s. I would have been, what am I, 56?
You're 56 now?
48. Yeah, so I would have been, is that right? No.
No.
49?
I don't know. How old's the kid?
The other side of 3.5. So it'll be four.
No, so you're like in your 50s.
Yeah, no, this is, I'm talking about the first one where she had an abortion. It would have been, I'm not good at the math here. No, she didn't abort our current child.
No, I know.
Yeah,
that.
You shouldn't do that. Yeah, you shouldn't
I didn't know we were telling an abortion story. I thought this was the fight that produced the first child. This was a different fight.
Well, it wasn't a fight. She
discussion,
got pregnant.
Discussion.
Yeah, she got pregnant when we weren't really trying for a baby, but we were okay with the idea, I guess.
And you weren't married yet.
We were married.
Oh, okay.
We were married.
Oh, interesting. Right.
And we had probably just gotten married. And so that was an issue. And, I supported her ultimately. It's like, you know, it's her body. It's her decision. Right. I'm not going to force her. I can't do that. I wouldn't do that. And it wasn't without a lot of discussion. And I understood why. I understood her reason, but I just wasn't happy with it. And so that happened, and that was a thing that we had in our lives, that was now permanently and forever moving forward, going to be a part of our history and relationship. And then we did, a couple years later, we're going to have a baby.
Well, let me ask you something though, like in that, like, you know, just because of the nature of who we are politically and, you know, who we are as comics and everything else. Now, after that decision, you know, which she wanted to have the abortion and you were against it because you wanted to have the child, it does, you know, I imagine the discussion of that hangs over you, but you don't think you don't think about that child necessarily, do you?
Only in an abstract sense.
Right.
Because I did... when she was pregnant, and I did, and I especially thought about it when we were upstate, because I just had this, when I go in the woods, I go for a walk with my dog or just walk in the woods.
Oh yeah.
And I would, imagine having like a 5-year-old,
right.
You know, holding a 5-year-old's hand and pointing things out all that kind of
right,
you know, romantic father imagery, and especially upstate.
Yeah,
and so I mean, I did in that sense,
right?
And I was also, going back to what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
It was this like, I'm ready to do this. I'm ready in a self-centered way.
Right.
I'm me. I'm ready to do this. And she wasn't. And, you know, we came to that understanding, but that's a lot of it was about. It's what 99% of it was about, was I'm ready. I want this. And
right.
She wasn't. And
right.
She's significantly younger, you know.
Sure.
And, so that was part of it. And then we got pregnant. She was ready. So
and now
we were happy to do that.
And now you got one.
Yeah. And she's awesome.
Three and a half?
3.5, yeah.
So you were 53 or so, 52? When did you turn 56?
April.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're like, I don't know. I just turned 57 in September. We're close.
I'm 56 and a half.
Okay. But
I really want to use this, your podcast, as a platform to try to encourage older people to start saying and a half. I think I'd like to see people on the floor of Congress going, now listen here, I'm 68 and a half years old.
I am 57 in 2 months, I think, almost. So now, like, I can't imagine it, but it must be like, but like, there's so many things in your life that, you know, you had resolved on some level. You know, you got money saved, you got a good marriage, and now, you know, you're at this age, because that makes me nervous. You know, because people are always like, you can have kids whenever you're a dude, but you know, you want to be part of it. And I think you got in just under the wire.
I think you're right. And I really am concerned about if we did have another one, like my energy level. I've always had a pretty good, you know, reserve of energy, and I'm pretty healthy and athletic, but like the idea of having another kid running around and having to run down the street while they're on a scooter. I mean, I literally, especially in Brooklyn, like I'm running like, stop, whoa, you know, this hauling ass constantly.
And people are, and because you're Dave Cross, there's always someone across the street laughing.
And I'll stop. I'll let her go into traffic just for a bit, and I'll sign some autographs.
She has to learn. She has to learn.
Do a quick cameo. the idea of like doing that again in 3 years from now, 3.5 years, like, forget it.
Well, do you think? Well, yeah, of course. But do you think like this idea of like how learning that you weren't as social as you thought you were, that you would rather not be hanging around with people as much? Do you think that, you know, the connection or whatever, however the kid opened your heart, that kind of made you realize your priorities and got you more sort of in touch with yourself?
For sure. And I, you know, it's every, you know, all the cliches are true. They're so trite, and they're trite for a reason, and they're wonderful, but the cliches are all true. And I'm aware of my language. I'm aware of my attitude, the energy I give off. I'm aware of,
So what, you don't say fuck, but do you still say cunt or no?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I say cunt in place of fuck. So I'll go, cunt.
Good for you.
And,
yeah.
And she goes, you know, what is that? What is cunt? What is, and I keep saying what?
Yeah.
And I can't hear you. What's that? I can't cunt hear you. It's really fun.
Yeah.
We have a lot of fun. That
way. It sounds fun.
But just morality. Think about morality I'm just more conscious of it.
Like, what do you mean?
Well, the lessons that I'm teaching.
All right, good and bad.
Yeah, what is right in behavior and how I act and things like that. And I try not to get to show my frustration with something as readily as I normally would.
Don't scare her with the weird outbursts of anger. Like, exactly, God damn it.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And your crankiness has subsided a bit?
I hope so. And I do hope so. I do hope so. I don't know if it has, the last, you know, 7 months have been brutal. The fact that one great thing about Amber and I's relationship was, you know, we were both in the business. So we both understood when, hey, somebody's got to go away for 2 weeks or 10 days or whatever it is. And we check in and we travel with each other a lot, but sometimes you just can't. And it's a relationship saver, you know, to have that built in, I get to be by myself. And same with her. She doesn't have to listen to me. And I'm not the easiest guy to live with. And,
So are you about to tell us that she's locked in a room or?
I've locked her in a room. She's in the basement. But I'm only telling you that because I want you to know that I have a basement. That's pretty cool.
Right. In Brooklyn. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
no, she's in Toronto actually right now.
She's shooting something too?
Yeah. Yeah.
God, everyone's going back to work.
That's why I was with the kid in Atlanta. I had to bring her down to Atlanta with me. And I was with her because Amber had to go. They have a very, very, very strict, she's in Canada, a very strict quarantine regimen. And they will track you and they will, you know, fine you heavily and kick you out. So, you know, they're not fucking around because they know how bad it is.
Is it a movie or a TV show?
TV show, FX.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's, I guess they're recasting GLOW and reshooting it.
Wait a minute. I'm supposed to. They fucking just bailed.
And I'm sorry to hear about that, man. I truly am. That was, you're so fucking wonderful in that.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
Really, really impressive.
I can't. Yeah, I mean, there. I mean, it's just one of those things. You know, there's nothing. You have no power in that thing. You know what I mean? I get it. I mean, the cast is so big. How are you gonna work around that? And when is it gonna be okay to shoot like that? There's just I really do think it was about that. I don't think, you know, there was just no way to do that safely, and no way to see when that could happen.
Well, it's again, I was nervous about, you know, going back to work, and there are ways to do it, you know.
Yeah. If you really lock it down,
perhaps you have to bubble, you know. Yeah. Much like NBA and
right,
and they did that successfully. I don't know how you get around that, especially for something like your show where you've got all that.
Yeah, I don't know,
close contact and everything.
I got
choreography.
I just, like, to me, it's like so much about doing what we do. And I'm not I don't know how to have fun generally, but just that the idea of having the exchange of ideas and being able to socialize on set and all that stuff, like all that stuff being removed, and you just kind of render it down to like, all right, ready, masks off, we're doing it.
Yeah.
All right, cut, masks on. It's just like, to me, it sounds terrible.
Yeah. You're right. You're right. And,
but I mean, work is work. I get it. But I save some money, so I'm not panicking about that. But it just doesn't sound fun. And there's also this idea. It's like, are we going to put our lives on the line to create entertainment product? Isn't that part of the fucking problem? But, I don't know. I don't know.
I'm with you on all of that. Yeah. And, as much as I am anything else, I'm also a writer, and there have been so many ideas I've thought, like, oh, this would be a cool idea to explore and to try to write and to develop
for stand-up.
You know, maybe not for stand-up, for like TV,
for
a series,
okay,
for a show.
Okay.
And then, you know, I think about it like in practical terms, like, how would I shoot that? This isn't a good idea. This would take, I couldn't do that. And I try to, telescope everything down to its
minimal,
like, core. Do I need to shoot this in New York? Can this be shot with just four people in a room? You know, like,
can we green screen all of this? Can we can we cut and paste people in?
It changes your approach, or at least changes my approach to how I, because I'm always with the stuff that I develop, it's usually about story. I want this kind of story to be told, and it just is not conducive to working under COVID conditions. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying. Look, you know, I outside of the loss that I experienced and outside of the, we're all in this sort of like horrendous grief zone around the world, you know, and the COVID and everything else. But like, it's made me reassess fucking everything, you know, like it's very weird to see show business in its raw form like this, that these people that have these shows, these nightly shows who are under contract have to do this work. It's the great leveler. It's like everybody's doing their goddamn, you know, network television shows from their couches, and on some level it's okay, but it does strip everything bare, and you start to realize, like, we really are song and dance people, and without the song and dance, we're just people sitting on couches. It's okay, but it's kind of like,
I mean, you you know, ended up, I don't want to say stumbled into it, but you ended up in the greatest COVID gig you could possibly have.
It's great.
WTF.
Not complaining. And, you know, and we make a living off it. And like, but now I've gotten to just work stand-up material. Because like, the weird thing is, Dave, and I don't know about you, but I'll admit it to you, I don't fucking miss stand-up at all. And I don't know why. You know, because I've done it my entire life. And
I'm surprised to hear you say that. I'm very surprised.
Well, I mean, it's like one of those things, though, where I think I miss, you know, working through stuff. Do you know what I mean? But like, you get into the habit, like, you know, for me, like, I'm going to go do sets at least 3 or 4 times a week, no matter what. So I've never not done sets, but I'll, you know, even if I didn't have anything, I'll go, I'll make myself do it. But there was something about just the time and the space and the loss and the COVID and everything else where it kind of forced me to reckon with myself and see where I'm at. And I'm pretty comfortable. Like, I'm okay doing nothing.
Did you prior to all this, did you have that kind of, innate need to do stand-up that stand-ups talk about, that, like, I don't know, man, I just got to get up there.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, for sure.
Did you have that before?
I did, but not, it wasn't to entertain people. It was a personal thing. And, like, because I dropped that last special right at the beginning of lockdown, like, I don't know that I'm going to get much better than that special. Like, that special is good. Yeah. Right. So, and now, like, but here's what I was going to say is that something's happening because I've started doing these live Instagrams every morning, and I'll do like, mm-hmm. I'll do like over an hour sometimes to, like, you know, anywhere from 500 to 1200, 1300 people, but thousands of people come watch it. But it's re-engaging that part of me that thinks on my feet, because you do the same thing. I got to talk through my shit. So
yeah, but I don't. This whole performing in a vacuum thing. I'm not comfortable with it. I don't. It makes me self-conscious.
No, I don't like it. I don't like. I'm not waiting for laughs, but I do like thinking out loud. And
okay. But I want to go back to something you said before about okay. how people are. You know, they're like, I've got to get up on stage and I just want to entertain people. And I always found that to be such bullshit.
I don't have
and,
that. Yeah.
I don't think most people do. I think I know plenty of people say it. A lot of people, it's like this altruistic thing that's what they're, what's driving them to the stage. And it's bullshit. It's a selfish, not that this is the end result is bad. It's still a good thing.
The reason I do it is basically to, you guys will sit and and listen to me, because this is how I know I exist and this is how I think. Enjoy. Right. Enjoy.
Yeah. I think that's how it is for most people. That thing, and so many people do that, like, I've got this need. I've got to get up there and entertain people. I got to make them laugh. Like, fuck you. You're so full of shit.
You know, I need you to see me and hear what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. But do you miss it?
I do. I do a lot. I think in part because it was combined with not working at all. I finished this one project I was developing. I got to where I was kind of contractually obligated to finish that. It didn't seem like it had all this kind of excitement behind it, moved on. And then I had nothing. I was not doing anything. And I was trying to force myself to write, and I really missed stand up. And I was in the kind of what I like to call the end of, I had like three phases to when I'm developing stuff, at least the last two specials and tours I did, where I just developed stuff out of nothing.
I watched one. That's when I reached out to you, right? Because it made me all nostalgic. When it was the one with the big colonic closer. Which one was that? Was that the last one? The colonic?
No, I think that was the one before. That was Make America Great Again.
Maybe.
Is that
yeah.
the one in the? Was I in a theater or a rock club?
I think it was a theater.
Yeah, that was Make America Great Again. That I'm pretty sure.
It's just so funny because I had this moment where that's when I reached out to you, because I'm watching it and it's like, because we go back to such a developmental time for both of us, there was something so familiar that I hadn't seen in a long time, but had that ran pretty deep in me, you know, like just watching you do stand up and sort of, you know, move through your stuff. I'm like, I remember this. And you do it. There was moments in there where I'm like, he's doing this just the first time right now.
No, that was all true. That was
no, but I mean, like every word of that was already set.
Well, pretty much, yeah. Right. I mean, I always riff within stuff, but
right.
that story, it was one of those. It was one of the handful of things I've done where I can, as I'm doing it, I can remember it. Even though it was a long time ago with Amber, when we were basically first dating, where I just remember, I can remember it visually right now. I remember the fucking place on Santa
sure.
Monica Boulevard. And,
yeah. Who doesn't Santa remember Monica their and, first colonic? I mean, that's like,
it's and to this day, only colonic.
Me too. Tom Agnes sent me to his guy in New York. It was this little African dude, and he had all these pictures. When you're waiting in the lobby, and he had these pictures of tribal peoples, with these long things that could come out of their asses because of what they eat. Like they, like literally these shits.
Oh, the tapeworms and stuff?
No, they were like, I said to the guy, I said, what is that, a shit snake? And he laughed and laughed. And he thought that was the greatest thing to call it, a shit snake.
Oh, he was patronizing you. There's no way he hadn't heard the term shit snake ever before. Come on.
Really? I don't know. I got a genuine laugh. It seemed like a real laugh. There was no reason for him to fake it. I already had my appointment. But you know, it was just like very disturbing. No, they weren't. It wasn't a parasite thing. It was literally, I think these people were eating tree bark or something. And mm-hmm. That was his way of saying, like, you don't want this to happen. And I'm like, dude, right. That's not going to fucking happen.
And were these like big, glossy, beautiful kind of motivational poster type prints?
They were almost like from a medical journal of some kind, you know, where they'd show the picture of the people like in the tribe, and then they'd show these horrendous things.
Am I understanding this correctly, that these were on his wall as
yes,
as
yes, yes, as like welcome, just sit, make yourself comfortable.
I want to go there. Yeah. Where, it's here in New York.
Yeah, ask Agna. Do you still talk to Agna by any chance? Where is he?
Oh gosh,
is
I haven't talked to him in a
does he
a long
doesn't
time.
He live on the moon or in Thailand or someplace?
Moon, Thailand.
I don't know where. I don't know where. I don't know where people go. I don't know. Are you in touch with anybody?
I mean, not really.
It's weird,
I told
right?
Yeah, I've become very antisocial.
I know, but you got the kid. That's great. But anyways, what were we doing? Where were we going? About improvising and missing stand-up.
So I was developing some more material, and I kind of do it in three phases, where I just sort of take a tape recorder and just go to I'll go to some place in Brooklyn and I talk for an hour and then I tape it, and what works I keep, and what, you know,
right,
et cetera, et
sure.
cetera. And as opposed to like going to clubs and doing 12-minute sets and stuff like that. I mean, I just do an hour and I tell people it's going to suck for a little bit.
That's what I do too. I just get a space and just go. Yeah do an hour,
great.
2 hours, figure it out.
And then, you know, phase two is like, okay, I think I know I'm getting close, and now I can sort of try. I'm not going to dick around anymore. Here's what I'm going to work on.
Right.
Work on that. That's an hour and 15. Things always inflate. And then phase three being like the much
phase three for me is
shorter.
Like the week before, where it's sort of like,
it's like for me, it's like a month where I'm trying to sequence things. And,
I always,
you know,
end up like, you know, I've got the callbacks. I know what's going on, but it's still like, it's still an hour and 20. Or it's an hour
right.
and 30. And I know,
right,
like,
right,
I want
right.
to get this down to 75. And that
yeah,
last,
exactly.
yeah, that last week where you break the outline, it's literally like you see what you want to do and you're like, this doesn't fit. No, no, no. And then there
yeah.
you go.
And not being so self-indulgent and precious about
right.
things that I love that,
right.
you know, people aren't digging. And look, if you give it, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 tries and you're not getting it, then just ditch it. You know,
yeah,
and move on.
Well, no, it was just great. It was great seeing you, and it made me feel like. Do you remember the name of that? You know that there are a couple of things I wanted to bring up. You remember Inner Beauty hot sauce, the Caribbean hot sauce? It had it was almost like it had a papaya, a mango, and a hot habanero.
Wait, that's vaguely familiar.
Yeah,
what
I feel like it was from our past. Inner Beauty. It
Inner
was like
Beauty. I do. Wait, what is that from?
I don't know. I think we ate it. I think we had a bottle of it, but they didn't make it for a long time, but they're making it again. That's all. I just want to tell you that. And the other thing is, it was a really hot habanero hot sauce. And I feel
not
like
the stuff at the Yucca Hut on Franklin.
No, this stuff, it's
Inner
similar.
Beauty.
Inner Beauty was a bottle. Right. You could buy it. And I feel like
okay.
somehow or another, the hot sauce, difficult food era was somehow tied to Bob Wilson's apartment for me always. So
yeah, sure.
But here's the question I want to ask. What was the name of that sub place that we used to get those subs on Mass Ave? Remember they had like the... Did it have a number in it? Like the five something five? Or
there was the meat bomb.
Right.
B-O-M-B. The meat bomb.
With like
and it was
four
literally
meats.
Every... It was everything they had.
Right.
And cheese.
Right.
It was around the corner from the Middle East.
It was right around the corner from Bob's. We could walk there from Bob's on Mass
it
Ave.
Was, what was it called?
Five
it was
Star
like,
or something?
That sounds right. Yeah.
Something like that.
It was
that.
On a Mass Ave. It was right either by TT's, TT the Bears or Middle East. And I mean, that's all. That area's changed.
Yeah.
Dramatically,
but we had that meat sandwich. We'd get the like four or five meats on there.
Yeah, and cheese and onions.
It was
and
crazy. It was like sausage, meatball, cheese steak. I think
everything they had, they just dumped it on the, you know, and it was when you're poor and drunk and then I just
remember you the next day holding your stomach, bent over, stopping.
Always holding your stomach and bent over.
But you're better now. So
I'm a lot better, yeah.
But now, okay, so tell me about all these hackneyed things about having a kid, though. Like, what? Because you seem like, do you tear up? Do you get overwhelmed with feeling? What happens?
Well, it's the highs are so high and the lows are just suck, you know. And we've been very lucky. She's you know, healthy and hasn't exhibited at this point any kind of real mental or learning deficiencies, and she's for the most part a happy, fun kid, funny. There's a lot of time where Amber's not here, you know, and she's out of town, and she had a whole run for like 6 or 7 months where she was doing all kinds of, you know, things, either promoting her stuff or some writing that had come out, or doing stuff for feminist causes or political people, you know, politicians or whatever. And she'd, you know, be gone for 4 or 5 days or whatever. And it's the most exhausting thing, like being with a kid sun up to sun down, you know, when they're, it's great, but it can be really, really just, you're just wiped out by the end of the day. Wiped the fuck out.
You don't have any help over there?
I do, but like when I was in
Georgia, yeah.
You know, I was in Georgia then, but Nanny has her own schedule and her issues too, and has her own life, and, you know, sometimes can't be here. Until Amber gets back, which will be in early November, I mean, yeah. It's just like, but it's been like that since she was a kid, really. I've been with her pretty much outside of 12 days where I went to Europe on the last tour, and made a talk about a lesson learned, a tremendous mistake, in that I was so nervous and depressed and upset that I was going to go away from her. I'd never been away from her for more than like a day and a half at that point, maybe 2 days tops. I designed my trip to Europe, and I didn't do half the shows that I did in the on the last tour, Oh Come On.
Yeah.
I didn't do half of those.
Right.
I only did 12 days. And I went and I flew in red-eye to Manchester, did a show that night as fucking out of it and jet-lagged and crazy. And then my last show was in Amsterdam, and had like a 6 a.m. pickup to go to the airport to fly from Amsterdam to Manchester back to New York.
Yeah.
Just so I could cut out whatever it is, a cumulative 14 hours off of the itinerary, so I could not be away from her for so long. And I walked in and she didn't give a fuck, man. She just, I was like, and I got my suitcase. Hey, and my dog's all excited. And like, Marlo, she's got her back to me. She's looking at the TV on the couch. Marlo, daddy, da da. Hello, hello. And she just kind of turned around, looked at me, didn't say a word, and went back to watching TV. And so I will never, ever make that mistake again.
Wow. And that's when you said to Amber, what the fuck is her problem?
Amber wasn't there.
Oh, just a nanny?
So, yeah.
That's sad.
But, yeah, I had 12 days there, and then I did this movie, The Dark Divide. Aren't we supposed to talk about that?
I watched the whole movie. I think that the sandwich place had the word high in it. Like high five,
yes.
high something.
High five pizza. High five pizza, yeah. That's it, high five pizza.
Oh, thank God. Yeah. Oh, good. All right, so.
The pizza had really quality fidelity.
Yeah, but the sandwiches were where it was at.
It was a great sounding pizza.
Yeah, awesome. But yeah, I watched the movie, man, and I was very proud of you. You seemed to like, you know, I thought like, well, this is a changing man. He's accessing, you know, it was like a deeper dive into a character, I think, than you usually do.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And it was moving, and it was a painful story, but also beautiful.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was you know, cool to do. It wasn't fun to do.
No, to be outdoors in Washington,
dude. It was like the lowest budget, most grueling. I mean, a lot of those scrapes and bruises were all real. And
did you get to spend time with the real guy?
Yeah, yeah, Robert Pyle, awesome guy.
He's butterfly guy.
And you know, it's not. It takes from a couple of his books,
right?
And there are some liberties taken with the story, but you know, it's 90% of it is all, you know.
So basically, the idea is that like his wife, he nursed until she died of cancer, and he'd always wanted.
But he was really kind of as sweet and nice and kind and avuncular as he is in real life. He's very. You know, he's shy and he isn't very proactive, and his wife is extremely extroverted. He's introverted. She's extroverted. And she was really the one who was holding, in a way, holding his life together. And he wouldn't have done anything without her pushing him to do
it.
And so that's like her dying thing to him is applying for him for the Guggenheim grant
to go find to document these species that have never been documented.
To go into this place it's you know, one of the last wild bits of the lower 48 states, and it's one of the last stretches that is very, you know, still very wild.
Is it still?
And I mean, you can hike it. It's just, there's no amenities. There's no, you know,
is that how you guys had to shoot it basically?
Yeah. With the skeleton crew, a lot of where we were, there was no, you know, there's no cell service, there's no electricity. And you couldn't access a lot of the parts, anything around those, like, the lava tubes,
yeah,
you know, a lot of that stuff, and people got hurt. You know, there were some, you know, albeit relatively minor, but there were a number of people who had to get, you know, some help. But you're out there. Also, there was a mountain lion that was like stalking. It was fucking nuts. And there was no like changing trailer. There was no craft services.
Oh,
you're out
God.
There. How? And you had to hike everything in there, equipment and everything, and then shoot. And if you see it's raining, that's because it rained. And the weather changes like that. I mean, it just changes.
Oh my God. How long was this shoot?
I think it was, I want to say 4 weeks. And the first week was in Portland. So it was 3 weeks out in the,
Out in the woods. It's like Apocalypse Now.
But not all of it. The stuff when you see like, when it's kind of nice out, and then there's like the we're on top of the ridge, like that wasn't scary or weird. But a lot of the stuff in the interior was really hairy and not fun. I mean, it was, and there's again, like there's no trailers, nowhere to get.
So
warm.
This was
there's
was this director like he was like just like this was his vision. This was he was willing to commit this insanity to it.
Yeah, he grew up in Portland and went to a lot of these places as a kid. And he, I can't remember how he came to know Robert Pyle's work, but he did. And then he kind of devoured all of his work. Now he's an accomplished writer. He wasn't at the time that the movie takes place in 95, I think.
But he's by training a butterfly guy.
Yeah, he's a lepidopterist.
Yeah.
That's his thing. Yeah. And now he's a lot more than that, but that's what he was when this journey, he goes on this journey and this thing happened to him. And so this guy got to know him. He got the rights to it. And I think it was about 10 years that he, you know, was trying to get this thing made.
But the impetus of it was that, you know, his wife had wanted him to do this and he didn't. Mm-hmm.
He kept saying he was going to do it.
And he
like,
never
I'm going to do it. I'll do it. I'm going to. Yeah, I definitely when it warms up, and then it would warm up. Well, I'm going to wait a little bit till this because I'm not really ready right now, but I will be. And he was always putting it off. And then she dies and she had applied for the grant knowing she was dying. She only had a matter of weeks left, and he gets accepted. and
has to go.
You know, she's already dead, so he's like, now he's got to do it.
And through that process, I mean, like, how did you approach it differently? Because it feels to me, it felt to me like this was something, you know, that you couldn't, you know, you couldn't just goof through. You couldn't just make a caricature and do it.
Right.
So, like, it has to be, there has to be some relationship between you coming to terms with yourself that enabled you to do this emotionally with this guy.
Well, to bring it all back around to where one of the things we were first starting to talk about, it's really about embracing that what I came to see myself as is antisocial and not it spoke to that part of me. And I could never do what this guy did. I mean, not in a million years. And I know everybody says, well, you could if you had to. I wouldn't. I'd be dead. I would quicken the death. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't survive it. So it was 128 miles, I think.
And he just went out by himself with very little.
He went out by himself. It was in way over his head.
Right.
He didn't know what the fuck he was doing.
Right.
And it was you know, like embracing the letting all those other facades fall away and go, all right, this is who I am. I've got to do this.
Right.
I'm going to do it. Because he has a couple moments where he could have bailed.
Right.
And he didn't. And he does it for her. And he knows deep down that he will change for the better. He knows it's hard. And he knows that she was the better person in that sense. And, you know, he's got her kind of memory and spirit there with him,
sure,
guiding him. And, you know, just and we do it in the movie and it was, you know, really happened to Robert, the real guy. But he thought he was in there for like, I can't remember what it was. He thought he was in there for like 28 days and he was in there for almost 40. Like he had just completely lost track
of
everything. Yeah. I can't remember the exact numbers, but we had a scene that we eventually took out where he puts on his he's leaving and he sees people on the dashboards of cars, like the name, a phone number to get in touch with a relative, when he's expected back, or
right,
that person, he or she is expected back. And he goes, oh, and he writes it on like a piece of paper and he puts it on his dashboard.
Right.
And he's off by weeks.
Yeah. I thought that was in the movie when he comes back to the car and realizes how long he's been gone. Or no.
Oh, well, maybe it was. I don't know. I've never seen it, so you'll have to tell me.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Why? Well, you don't want to see it?
No, I've seen it 150 times.
Oh, it's
just
not,
doing
so it's not
cuts
in there.
And
oh.
ADR and stuff.
Oh.
I don't remember.
But yeah, it was, I don't think, like, I think you keep saying you're antisocial. I think you're just more comfortable with yourself.
Oh, wow.
I think when you go running around and you got to, it's like that thing you were saying, you're looking for something outside of yourself, whatever it is, you know, to kind of, you know, make yourself feel better. And I think you just probably just, you know, kind of more comfortable with yourself. If you're lucky, that happens when we get older, you know, a lot of things don't matter.
I never thought about it that way, but that's interesting. And I will give that some thought. Maybe that's interesting.
Okay. Do whatever you have to do with it.
All right, I'm going to take off. And actually, I do kind of have to run.
No, it's good. It's good. It's fine. But the movie was good and it's great to see you. And I thought you worked well with Deborah Messing, and I thought the journey was good, and the Bigfoot thing was. Am I spoiling it?
No, I mean that's. I think they did a really good job of handling that.
Not ridiculous.
Yeah, it's not ridiculous. I mean, that was a big. I every step of the way, I was like, you guys can't show Bigfoot. You can't do this. You can't do that. I mean, it has to be just.
Is it in the book?
The thing at the very end, I don't want to give it away, but you know, the literally the very end,
right,
happened, but not quite in that way. But that did happen.
Yeah.
He did come upon a print.
Okay. Yeah.
And I know this guy he's a scientist. You know,
right.
it was a really difficult, and people, you know, when they're interviewing me about the movie, they're like, do you believe in Bigfoot? And I do not. I don't believe in it. But I do believe in the ability for mankind to invent things. And but I thought what he says something in his book, he writes about how there's every reason to think that a Bigfoot could exist and has the wherewithal to not make himself known,
right,
especially in that part of the country.
I guess that becomes clear to you when you're out in it, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, and have you been to like Central Oregon?
I haven't spent time there. No.
It's one of the most fucked up. I grew up in the South.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most fucked up. I mean, it's weird in a way I have not experienced.
What do you mean, like hill people wise?
Kind of. Not that they're scary, but just they're very, it's almost Twins
right,
Peak-ish, like, in that like it's a culture that is unto them, and they're very suspicious people. It's weird. I haven't felt that kind of vibe since I've been in like the deep South, like in Appalachia,
right.
Appalachia.
Yeah.
Appalachia.
There's hill people all over the place.
But I'm telling you, man, maybe just cause I'm used to the South and,
right,
and when you go, especially in the
upstate New York's the, got them too, dude.
Not like this, man.
Maine?
Not like this.
All right. Okay. All right.
Maine, maybe. Maybe Maine. I haven't been to like super rural Maine. And I think it's kind of a similar, you know, just a suspicion,
yeah,
and not the friendliest vibe.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah.
It's what you can imagine a lot of QAnon, you know,
sure.
stuff.
The kind of like sort of, hi, how you doing? Just passing through?
Yeah.
I guess.
So. Yeah. I am now.
Yeah,
it's a trip, man.
All right. Well, it was I enjoyed watching the movie, and I liked the movie, and you know, you did a good job.
Well, thanks, man. And it's truly great to see you and your success and how you've been able to branch out as well and do that stuff.
Thanks, man.
As well, which is an opportunity we haven't often gotten to do. So
no, sir.
You know?
Yeah, and I'm excited. Yeah. It's great talking to you. Great seeing you. I love you, man.
And you as well, man.
Take care.
All right. Bye.
David Cross. He felt that ending was abrupt. I guess it was, but I do that sometimes, don't I? We were done. He felt done. Kind of felt like it was done. You can go to darkdividefilm.com to get the virtual cinema links for the movie The Dark Divide that Dave and I just talked about. Good luck, everybody. Good luck. I'll be back on the Instagram Lives probably Thursday. And the T-shirts, the Marin Too Close shirts, are selling like hotcakes. It's a good shirt. You can go to podswag.com or go to WTFpod.com. Click the merch button. I think it's one of the better shirts we've done. I don't even know why. It's got a vibe. It's a nice teal color. Whatever. Guitar? How about a little guitar? All right. Okay, here we go. Good luck. Oh, my God. Monkey lives. LaFonda lives. Vote. Vote. I miss you, Lynn Shelton.